Republicans have had 16 years to come up with something better. Why isn't there something in place to replace the ACA with then?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Great question. Bad answer. GOP Rep. Tom Tiffany of Wisconsin.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's the only answer you got.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Welcome to another thrilling edition of The Bradcast as we near year's end. Monthly health insurance premiums for those who purchased health care via the Obamacare or ACA exchanges, well, those are set to skyrocket for millions of Americans. Other health care related costs will likely go up in the bargain, even for those who did not purchase their health care via the Affordable Care Act. And costs are set to go up for millions of Americans on both Medicaid and Medicare, all thanks to enormous historic cuts made to the programs across the board in the Trump Republican so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act passed earlier this year. It was thanks to those cuts that Democrats stayed unified in both chambers of Congress for 43 days this fall to keep the government shut down until those critical cuts were restored, or in this case, until seven rogue Democrats and one independent who caucuses with them in the Senate decided otherwise and gave the Republicans the votes that they needed to reopen the government in exchange for no more than a promise to hold a vote on restoring Affordable Care Act subsidies in the GOP-controlled Senate, where 60 votes are needed for passage in the 100-seat chamber, with no promise for a vote in the GOP-controlled House at all. All of which is leading straight over a high-stakes and even deadly healthcare cliff at year's end. We will be joined momentarily by a longtime Capitol Hill healthcare reporter to get the lay of the political landscape as this battle, I guess, reheats up as we move into the critical midterm election year. We've also got our latest Green News report with Desi Doyen for you coming up later this hour.
Yes, we do.
Hi, Desi.
Hi.
If I can manage to stay on schedule for a change. And by the way, that is not easy given the amount of breaking news that has been coming in minute by minute today. So quickly, first, there's a bunch of still developing stories in the news today. Each of them are changing quickly. I've got just a few short minutes here, so let me try to touch on several of them briefly for now, with more, I suspect, in the coming days. The FBI arrested a 30-year-old Virginia man and charged him on Thursday with planting a pair of pipe bombs in Washington, D.C. on the night before the Donald Trump-incited January 6, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol by his supporters seeking to overturn the U.S. government and block the confirmation of Joe Biden's 2020 victory over then-President Trump. The arrest comes after a years-long investigation that gave rise to numerous conspiracy theories on the right, often advanced by, well, the two men that now run Trump's FBI, Director Kash Patel and his deputy Dan Bongino, both formerly right-wing podcasters, until they were tapped by Trump to run the world's premier law enforcement agency. The suspect, now in custody, Brian Cole Jr. of Woodbridge, Virginia, was charged with use of an explosive device and attempted malicious destruction by means of explosive materials, according to Attorney General Pam Bondi and other federal officials in a D.C. press conference on Thursday. Bondi and other officials did not say what motivated the alleged bomber to plant devices outside both the Republican and Democratic Party buildings near the Capitol that night, or reveal what new break in the case led to the arrest nearly 5 years after the incident. Quote, "This investigation is ongoing," Bondi said. "As we speak, search warrants are being executed and there could be more charges to come." Okay. Police deactivated the bombs the day that Trump supporters stormed Congress in an attempt to stop lawmakers from certifying Biden's victory after a weeks-long attempt by Donald Trump to steal that year's elections. Thousands of rioters attacked the Capitol that day, assaulting about 140 officers, resulting in several deaths, causing more than $2.8 million in damage. And Trump has since pardoned all of the attackers that day, about 1,500 of them. The suspect, now in custody for this apparent attempted bombing, is said to live with his parents in Woodbridge, a suburb about 20 miles outside of D.C., and that he works for a bail bond company, according to a court filing. The would-be bomber has long been the subject of conspiracy theories in pro-Trump MAGA circles. Bongino himself previously claimed, without any evidence, on his podcast that he believed the FBI knew the suspect's identity, but refused to reveal it because it was, quote, an inside job, he said. More on that to come, no doubt, on that story very soon. Meanwhile, the Defense Department's top watchdog issued in a report released Thursday that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's actions in the Signalgate affair, quote, created a risk to operational security, contradicting claims made by Hegseth and his aides just one day earlier, claiming that the report from the IG amounted to, quote, a total exoneration for the embattled Hegseth. Apparently it didn't. The inquiry by the Defense Department's Office of Inspector General determined that by using the unclassified chat app Signal to share advanced details about a forthcoming bombing operation in Yemen, Hegseth's actions, quote, created a risk to operational security that could have resulted in failed U.S. mission objectives and potential harm to U.S. pilots. The report cited Hegseth also for using the unsecured app on his unclassified personal device to relay that information via group chat to other top Trump administration officials and for not retaining all associated messages in violation of federal record-keeping laws. In other words, he destroyed the evidence. Top lawmakers on the Senate Armed Services Committee requested the inquiry back in March after Atlantic Magazine's top editor and longtime national security reporter Jeffrey Goldberg had reported that he had been inadvertently added to the group chat and bore witness to its contents. The other participants in the chat included Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and other cabinet officials. The episode, revealed in March by Goldberg, led Democrats to demand Hegseth's resignation. At the time, he has yet to resign. The report's release this week comes as Hegseth faces fresh scrutiny for his involvement in the Trump administration's deadly and almost certainly wildly unlawful military campaign off the coast of Venezuela, amid burgeoning bipartisan congressional inquiries seeking to determine whether a war crime or more may have been committed there. Senior Democratic lawmakers briefed on one of those U.S. strikes on an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean said on Thursday that they were deeply troubled by a video showing survivors in distress being killed in a subsequent rocket attack, which is a strict violation of U.S. and international law and rules of war. Though Republican lawmakers, according to Reuters, at the same briefing, defended the strike as legal. The incident under scrutiny is the September 2 attack by the U.S. military that struck a vessel in the Caribbean, killing 11 alleged drug traffickers. The initial strike left two survivors clinging for their lives to the destroyed wreckage of the boat before they were also subsequently killed following orders said to have been issued by Hegseth to kill everyone on the boat. Admiral Frank Bradley, who was the head of the Joint Special Operations Command at the time, and Dan Kane, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on Thursday briefed lawmakers on the operation and reportedly showed an unedited video of that second strike in the classified briefing. Congressman Jim Himes of Connecticut, the top Democrat on the House Intel Committee, told reporters after the briefing, quote, "You have two individuals in clear distress without any means of locomotion with a destroyed vessel who were killed by the United States." He added that it was, quote, "one of the most troubling things," unquote, that he had seen, but said Admiral Bradley confirmed he did not receive a, quote, "kill them all" order. Okay. Then why did someone give the order to fire the second round? That still remains unclear at this hour. Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, the top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, said that he was, quote, "deeply disturbed" by the video and said it should be released to the public. Quote, "this briefing confirmed my worst fears about the nature of the Trump administration's military activities," Reed added in a statement. But Tom Cotton of Arkansas, the Republican chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said that Bradley and Hegseth did exactly what was expected of them. Quote, "I saw two survivors trying to flip a boat loaded with drugs bound for the United States back over so they could stay in the fight." I guess flip the boat back over, Cotton said, adding that it was possible that other suspected drug boats could have come to their aid and recovered the drugs on board. But their boat was blown up from the air by the U.S. military. They were hanging on to it for their lives, and the administration has offered no evidence, by the way, none, zero, that they were bound for the United States. But really, they were going to somehow turn over the boat and then escape U.S. rocket fire somehow? Before the briefing, a U.S. official said that Admiral Bradley, who now heads U.S. Special Operations Command, would tell lawmakers that the survivors were legitimate targets for a second attack because their vessel was still believed to contain illegal narcotics.
They had no chance of getting to the United States.
But Defense Department's Law of War Manual could not be clearer on this. Section 18.1.2.3 strictly forbids attacks on combatants who are incapacitated, unconscious, or shipwrecked, provided that they abstain from hostilities and that they're not attempting to escape. The manual cites firing upon shipwreck survivors specifically as an example of a, quote, "clearly illegal order that should be refused." Under the U.S. Department of Defense Law of War Manual.
Yeah, and the fact that Senate Republicans like Tom Cotton have defended that second strike, despite that example, the example being do not fire on shipwrecked survivors, I find that extremely disturbing that we have Republican lawmakers who are planning that kind of thing.
Listen, we haven't seen the video. They saw the video. We will see it when it hopefully gets released. Donald Trump has said no problem releasing it. So we'll all get to see it for ourselves. Much more on that, no doubt, in the hours and days and months ahead, I suspect. And while there had been reporting on Wednesday that the DOJ was planning to reindict New York Attorney General Letitia James on mortgage fraud claims on Thursday, after her previous indictment was dismissed last week by a federal judge in Virginia, who found that the interim U.S. Attorney Lindsey Halligan, an insurance lawyer with no prosecutorial experience appointed by Donald Trump specifically to indict James and former FBI Director James Comey, finding that she was unlawfully appointed to her post in the Eastern District of Virginia U.S. Attorney's Prosecutor's Office. So that was tossed out, but there was news that she would be reindicted. On Thursday, the administration reportedly brought in another prosecutor to reindict Tish James. But moments before air, CNN is reporting that the grand jury has now declined to reindict Tish James. If true, it would be yet another stunning failure in Donald Trump's attempted revenge presidency, though it's possible the administration could try yet again, I suppose, with either another grand jury or different charges. And finally, speaking of failures, or maybe for this administration, it's a success. I don't know. Donald Trump's unlawful dismantling of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has contributed to the first rise in global child mortality since at least 1990, according to a new report. Nearly a quarter of a million more children under the age of five are now projected to die worldwide in 2025 than in 2024. After the administration stopped the delivery of critical life-saving medicine to nations around the world earlier this year. As to the threat of children unnecessarily dying in this country, as Republican cuts to health care begin to kick in at year's end, well, unless Democrats are able to somehow pass a measure to restore those cuts, somehow. Well, on that issue and the political landscape ahead for all of this, we are joined by Politico healthcare reporter Alice Miranda Olstein right after a quick break. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.
She usually does. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblogs.com on a very busy news day today. Thank you for staying with us. The Trump administration's singular legislative accomplishment, if you can call it that, in its first year was the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act, adopted on a party line vote by Republicans in Congress and eagerly signed by Donald Trump over the summer. In addition to slashing taxes by about $1 trillion, largely for the wealthy and corporations, and increasing the national debt by about $2.5 trillion, the measure included all kinds of cuts to government services, including nearly $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid, the largest such cut in the nation's history, to health care for impoverished and low-income Americans. The bill also failed to renew hundreds of billions of dollars in Biden-era subsidies to help low- and middle-income Americans purchase health care policies via the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, or ACA, which will double or triple or more the monthly premiums for tens of millions of Americans as of January 1. It will result in about 3 million Americans immediately losing access to health care and perhaps as many as 15 million Americans losing that access in the coming years, according to most estimates. Thanks to the trillions of dollars the Trump Republican budget bill adds to the deficit, the measure will also result in automatic cuts of about $500 billion to Medicare as well over the next 8 years or so. With all of that in place, especially the huge immediate spikes in healthcare costs to those who have purchased policies on the ACA exchanges, congressional Democrats refused to help Republicans pass a continuing budget resolution to keep the government open as of October 1 this past year. They remained united on that front during what became a record-long 43-day shutdown of many federal services before 7 Democratic senators and 1 independent who caucuses with them buckled against the rest of their party as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, had run out of money and the Trump administration refused to follow court orders to restore its funding. In exchange for voting with Republicans to temporarily reopen the government, at least through the end of January, the Democrats won, well, pretty much nothing, those 7 Democrats, other than a promise for a vote on restoring GOP cuts to health care subsidies in the Senate at some point in December. No similar promise was given in the House, nor was there any promise from the White House that Donald Trump would actually sign any such restoration of funding, even if somehow both chambers of Congress were able to adopt a measure to do so. But given that so many Americans who purchase health care via the Obamacare exchanges, who will, as of January 1, see their monthly premiums skyrocket without those subsidies, since so many of them, in fact, a majority, I believe, now live in jurisdictions with Republican representation, it seemed a reasonable assumption that heading into a critical midterm election year with majority control of both chambers of Congress now apparently on the line, that Republicans would not want to be seen as responsible for doubling or tripling the health care costs for millions of Americans. That surely enough of those Republicans in Congress would come around to supporting the restoration of the ACA subsidies that Republicans cut over the summer to save access to health care and keep costs from skyrocketing for tens of millions of Americans before year's end. Or if not, they would end up paying a very steep price for that themselves at the polls next year. So how is that bet going? When will we see that vote in the Senate? Will there ever be one to go with it in the House? And would the White House even sign on to it? If so, after years of trying to kill the Affordable Care Act, as Republicans like to say, root and branch. And oh yeah, what happened to that much better and cheaper health care coverage plan that Trump and Republicans have been promising now for years, but never actually unveiled as promised, even as recently as just a week or two ago? As we head towards that health care cliff, now just days away at this point, I can think of no one better to ask about all of this to help us understand the political lay of the land here at year's end than our old friend Alice Miranda Olstein, senior healthcare reporter for Politico Pro, who has over the years been one of our go-to sources on the Capitol Hill beat when it comes to healthcare policy and or lack thereof. At Politico this week, Alice wrote about some of this in her piece with Robert King, headlined "Why Republicans Aren't Eager to Cut an Obamacare Deal." She's also the author of the upcoming book, Side Effects, which we will ask her about as well. Oh, Alice Olstein, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
I was going to note how remarkable it is that we are still talking about Republican opposition to Obamacare. Now, some 15 years since its initial passage, and now with some 25 million Americans using it to access health care. But maybe I shouldn't be so surprised, given that Republicans are actually still trying to gut Medicaid, which was adopted 60 years ago.
Both healthcare reporters, healthcare lawyers are going to have full employment forever because these fights are never, ever over. They die down and they come back, but they're never over. And we're in another one right now. There's nothing like a looming deadline to juice Congress into action, although that action may not lead anywhere, especially this time.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a moment. I do want to make sure, though, before we get to how each of these parties are planning to move forward, if at all, as we reach what could be a healthcare apocalypse after the new year. Did I basically lay out, at least in my intro, the political moment, the political landscape and the stakes mostly accurately as you see it as a Hill reporter who's much closer to all of this this beat than I am?
So, I want to stress that, there are a bunch of Republicans who do want to cut a deal. They are very anxious about both the concrete ramifications of letting the subsidies expire, you know, that millions of their constituents will have higher bills, become uninsured, et cetera. And they're worried about the political consequences. They're worried this will backfire in the 2026 midterms. You know, even if they, you know, try to make the argument that, you know, Obamacare is a Democratic creation, and that, you know, the subsidies and their expiration date were created by Democrats, so that, you know, public blame should fall on them, that might not work. It's a gamble. You know, mm-hmm. people getting higher bills are also likely to blame the party in power when they get those higher bills.
Indeed. Well, part of the agreement that was made with Republicans to reopen the government by those seven rogue Democratic senators and one independent last month that I mentioned is that they would get a vote on restoring the expanded premium subsidies in December, that the Democrats themselves could write whatever bill they wanted. I assume at least that vote is still on schedule.
Yes. So that is likely to happen next week. It could always change. But basically, Democrats announced that they're going to put forward a clean extension. So just a straight extension of the current subsidies for a few more years. And that is expected to fail on the floor in the Senate. And it's unknown if and when the House will take that up. And it's also unknown what Republicans will put forward as an alternative, if anything.
And that would still need to overcome the 60-vote filibuster in the Senate to pass out of that chamber, correct?
That's right. And Democrats in the House have also tried to use the discharge petition method to force a vote if House Republican leadership does not schedule it themselves. And so they are looking for just a small handful of Republicans in the House to cross the aisle and sign on, not to necessarily support the bill, but just to have a vote at all. And again, it's unknown where that's going. But to what I was saying before, you know, I my piece was about the Republicans who are completely fine letting these subsidies die. And there are enough of them to make this, you know, a very, you know, uphill battle for those who hope to maintain them. Mm-hmm. But I want to, you know, emphasize that the party is very divided. The Republican Party. And so there are those who are downplaying both the material and political consequences of the subsidies expiration, but there are others who say, no, look, we have to do something.
Yeah, and that was sort of, well, that was the gamble that I know that, you know, as I understand it, that, you know, Democrats thought that Republicans would not want to be held accountable for these coming spikes in an election year, and that by forcing the issue, in one sense, Democrats were actually, in truth, helping Republicans save themselves from themselves by taking this off the table in an election year. But the Republicans you talk about, I mean, all of this seemed like a fair gamble from the Democrats, but, you know, there were a number of Republicans in purple districts likely to face very serious challenges to their seats by Democrats next year. But you and Robert King report that there's a movement among these supposed conservative Republicans to just say no to expanding ACA subsidies, no matter the political costs next year. Are they understanding the costs, or do they just not care?
It's a mix. So some say that the political costs have been exaggerated. They point to polling from conservative organizations that they say is more accurate than polling from sort of, you know, mainstream groups to argue that the public will not be as upset as other polling has found. You know, they've also argued that, look, and you know, this is fair. We don't know what will be the big overriding thing on voters' minds when the midterms roll around. It's too far in advance to know. And so, yes, people who start seeing higher bills in January are going to be pissed about that.
Yeah.
They're already pissed because they're getting the notices now. There's been a lot of backlash, but, you know, it could be overshadowed by other issues. We just have no idea. And even in the, you know, cost of living space, you know, as some strategists have pointed out to me, you know, the cost of things like food and housing are much more immediate and apply to everyone, whereas the cost of Affordable Care Act health insurance, one, is hitting fewer people. Mm. And, you know, look, you go to the doctor once in a while, but you have to eat every day, usually. And so they are, again, making this gamble that it's not going to be the top thing on voters' minds when the midterms roll around, or that voters will blame Democrats, or that it won't, you know, have as damaging an impact as has been predicted.
You report at Politico that, quote, many on the right expect the political fallout to be minimal or even to backfire on Democrats. Really? I mean, I guess I can understand the argument that the fallout would be minimal, as you say. You know, not everybody uses their health care every single day. I guess that could that argument could be made. But how could this actually backfire on Democrats here as they see it?
Yeah, in their theory, you know, look, the Affordable Care Act is obviously associated in the public's mind with Democrats, and opposing it is associated with Republicans. And so, you know, these conservatives are telling us, look, you know, we have hated Obamacare since it was just a suggestion 15 years ago. We're not going to suddenly become different people and start supporting it now. You know, they didn't vote for the creation of Obamacare in the first place. They didn't vote for the creation of these enhanced subsidies in 2021. And they didn't vote to extend these enhanced subsidies over the last few years. And so, you know, they're not going to suddenly start supporting it now. And, you know, it really varies district to district, but you have plenty of Republicans who are in very red districts who are more afraid of a primary challenge from the right attacking them for, quote unquote, supporting Obamacare, even if it's just a short-term extension with conservative reforms, which has been what's been discussed on the Hill in the past couple weeks. They're more afraid of that than they are afraid of having to face accusations of, oh, you let the subsidies expire and that raised people's bills.
They're afraid of being primaried out by someone to their right on Obamacare, even though many of these districts, many of these red districts, have a lot of folks signed up to the ACA in those districts, right?
That's right. So there's been a huge amount of growth in Obamacare enrollment in recent years, in especially the red states that never expanded Medicaid, mm-hmm. which, you know, makes sense. People need insurance and that's where they're going to get it. And so you, in places like Florida, you've just had massive, massive enrollment. And so, you know, this is set to hit a bunch of Republican voters. One of my sources also pointed out, and we included this in the story, that a group of people that you don't normally think about is set to be impacted a lot. And that's people who retired early. They had been wanting to retire, but they were afraid of losing their health insurance. But since Obamacare's market was created, oh, that way they could retire and get an individual plan. And so, you know, those folks are older. They're not old enough to qualify for Medicare. This was sort of the stopgap. And, you know, if they start having to pay a lot more in health insurance, you know, that is a constituency that Republicans may not want to lose.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me they are absolutely playing with fire here. I was actually surprised by your report at Politico that there were so many Republicans who were willing to ring in to say, yeah, we don't care. It's not going to hurt us that bad. One quote from this is genius Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson. He told reporters this week, quote, "Democrats have to start acknowledging they blew it. Obamacare has been a huge disaster." But Alice Ohlstein, that does not seem to be how the American people, especially the more than 20 million people who have it, actually, it doesn't seem how that's how they feel about it. They don't. Obamacare is now quite popular. No,
it not only has become more popular, and when there have been threats to it up on Capitol Hill, it tends to become more popular. We've seen this in 2017. We saw it play out. The public really rallied to oppose repealing Obamacare. But also just as the years go on, it's become more and more entrenched in our healthcare system. And even though there have been some discussions about, like you said, root and branch, repeal and replace,
right,
those haven't really gone anywhere. We haven't seen a real comprehensive plan for that. And you even have a lot of folks on the right saying that ship has sailed. It's become too entrenched in our healthcare system. It's sort of too late to completely undo it. And so, you know, opposing the subsidies, you know, which they argue should only be thought of as a temporary COVID era measure. And now that COVID has receded, it's not necessary anymore. But like you said, all of these are gambles.
Yeah, seems like big gambles. And the other point, since you raised that, Alice, that I think needs to be made clear by Democrats is that, you know, while they added these so-called enhanced subsidies during the COVID pandemic, and in fact, they had always wanted to increase the subsidies, but they sort of had to get what they could get in order to get it passed at first. And then ever since, they had really been trying to increase those subsidies. COVID sort of gave them an opportunity to do so. But the additional subsidies weren't so much for COVID specifically, as you heard a lot of Republicans saying, oh, COVID is over, therefore we don't need these additional subsidies. It was something that everyone knew was needed after the initial passage of the ACA way back in 2010. No, at least the Democrats knew. They were always trying to find a way to increase the available subsidies. No?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the argument from Republicans right now is, look, this is a dilemma of Democrats' own making. Democrats set this expiration deadline, and here we are. And why should we, the Republicans, bail out the Democrats, you know, out of a problem of their own creation? But like you said, the reason the deadline, the expiration is when it is because they didn't have the votes to make it to make it longer. They wanted to make it permanent or, you know, extend for many more years. And some more conservative Democrats who were in office at the time, including Joe Manchin, opposed that. And they wanted to keep the overall cost of the bill down. And so they settled for these, you know, short-term extensions, which are now biting everybody in the butt, I guess.
Yeah, there's another point that I'm hoping you may be able to help us, debunk, I think. One of the arguments that I've seen of late from Republicans, which sounds persuasive on its surface, is that, is the way I heard it put originally, that nobody making more than $300,000 a year should receive subsidies from working class folks to help pay for their health care. I think you quote healthcare fraudster Senator Rick Scott saying $250,000. No one, you know, we shouldn't have to subsidize them. But as someone who is self-employed myself and using the ACA exchanges, therefore, are there really people out there who are earning $250,000, $300,000 a year who are receiving federal subsidies for their monthly premiums on the Obamacare exchanges?
So a few things. It is true that higher income people are receiving subsidies, and it's especially true that, you know, these enhanced subsidies go over the cap that was on the original subsidies of 400% of the federal poverty level. Mm-hmm. So that is people making six figures. I think multiple things can be true at once. One, Republicans who oppose the subsidies overall are using the argument that, you know, this is benefiting the wealthy and they don't need it, they don't deserve it, while not acknowledging that, you know, lower income people are also set to lose the subsidies and they won't be able to weather it as well as the higher income people. I think it's also important to remember that, you know, even someone who makes six figures, if they're having to pay, you know, health insurance can cost, you know, tens of thousands a year. So even someone making six figures, that's a real struggle. Obviously, it's not as much of a struggle mm-hmm. as it is for a lower income person, but mm-hmm. you can be fairly well off and still not able to afford health insurance. Those things can be true at once.
And, you know, I'm not a healthcare wonk the way you are, Alice, but won't the loss of subsidies for Obamacare, not to mention the huge cuts to Medicaid, which I don't think, by the way, are those cuts in this bill the Democrats are going to bring up in December, does that include restoration of Medicare funds, or is it only dealing with Obamacare?
What they're discussing, we haven't seen bill text, but what they're right. discussing is just an extension of these.
Okay. Now, with the loss, if that doesn't pass in the Senate and the House and get signed by Donald Trump, the loss of those subsidies for Obamacare, along with, of course, the cuts to Medicaid, don't those end up resulting in first, millions of people dropping out of the coverage pool? And because of that, doesn't that raise the healthcare costs for everyone, not just those who are covered by the ACA or Medicaid?
Right. And so this is the, if folks remember the term death spiral, mm-hmm. This is what, you know, health economists warned about, because the people most likely to drop their coverage entirely are the people who are like, well, I'm pretty healthy, I may not need it, and this is a cost that I'm able to pay, so I'm just going to roll the dice and go uninsured. Those younger, healthier people are what we're keeping costs for everyone in the market. Mm-hmm. And so if they leave and only the sicker people with higher healthcare needs stay because, you know, they need insurance, they have no choice really, their costs are set to go up. And so, yes, that has spillover effects into the employer healthcare market. It has spillover effects into Medicare. Yeah. It really, you know, has ripple effects throughout the whole healthcare system. And just briefly going back to your question before about, you know, Republicans arguing that higher income people shouldn't, you know, be rewarded, basically. Mm-hmm. Some of the alternative plans they have been pitching in recent weeks, a lot of them involving health savings accounts or flexible savings accounts, and money would go in there instead of being as an insurance subsidy, that structure would definitely benefit higher income people more. So it's just something to keep in mind.
And that plan, by the way, it was supposed to be, the White House itself had promised, oh, we're going to have our plan next week. And then theoretically, they had a plan and then they decided to pull it back. Do we know anything more about what was in that plan, why they pulled it back, and whether they actually ever planned to release anything on this?
I think that was really telling. So basically, it was a trial balloon. They, you know, had sort of a broad outline of a short-term subsidy extension with some of these conservative reforms Republicans have wanted, such as income caps. You know, if you make over a certain amount, you don't get any subsidies, and other, you know, other provisions as well. When news of that got out, there was a big backlash from Republicans on Capitol Hill. You know, one, they, you know, just from the folks who oppose any extension of Obamacare subsidies at all, but also, you know, people opposed to the specifics. And after that backlash, the White House said, okay, never mind. And not only have they not rolled out a plan, but, you know, my colleagues had a great story up this week about White House is not really giving a lot of guidance as Republicans on Capitol Hill are scrambling to put together something in the next few weeks. Now, you know, that can be dangerous because Congress isn't sort of willing to stick their necks out and take a vote on something if they have no idea if the White House is on board or not. And so that lack of guidance is really leaving them in a lurch.
So, Alice, with all of those things that we do not know, I certainly don't want to ask you for predictions here, but do you or anyone in Congress that you've spoken with have any actual idea what this all means, how this is going to somehow play out or get resolved? Are Republicans really willing to go into, as far as your reporting goes, are they really willing to go into an election year where they're already up against it, where they're already on their heels amid the, you know, the so-called affordability crisis? They've got a wildly unpopular president. And then go through, you know, a full election year with Americans paying thousands of dollars more for their health care. All of that seems like suicide for the Republicans, to me, is that really where they seem to be going? Or is there a real search? Do they really understand that they need some sort of resolution here and fairly quickly at this point?
So again, they're divided. You have a camp that is very worried and is scrambling to put together some kind of plan. You know, you even have some sort of nation bipartisan attempts to cobble together some kind of agreement, but nothing has majority support at this point. Democrats' clean extension doesn't have majority support. You know, these bipartisan attempts don't have majority support, and the conservative alternatives don't have majority support. And so today, I don't think anything anyone has talked about can pass, and that would mean that the subsidies go away.
And by the way, do they actually need majority support? In other words, if the Democrats are willing to come fully on board, they don't need to pull off that many Republicans in each chamber, no, to get something that passes?
That's true, but there are not signs that even, you know, even those few votes are gettable at this point.
Man, boy, this is going to be a mess for someone. And just my wild guess, I think it's going to be a mess for both the people who can't pay anymore for healthcare, but on a political level, for the Republicans. I think they're going to pay a big price for this. Alice Miranda Olstein, before I let you go, your Blue Sky account notes that you've got a forthcoming book coming out. Its new title is now Side Effects. I think it doesn't come out until next year, but you want to give us the elevator pitch on that as a preview before you go?
Absolutely. So, yes, I have a book based on years of reporting. I've done a Politico on the fallout from the fall of Roe versus Wade and how it's just rippled throughout our healthcare system, and it's affecting lots of kinds of healthcare that are completely unrelated to reproduction or reproductive health. It's affecting everything from how doctors are educated and trained to management of chronic illnesses, how medical research and clinical trials are conducted, just up and down our healthcare system, trying to document all of these impacts that people might not know about.
Interesting. You mean when you mess with one part of the healthcare system, it affects all of the others?
Indeed.
Something that folks may want to keep in mind on Capitol Hill in the days ahead. Alice Miranda Olstein is the senior healthcare reporter for Politico Pro. You can, of course, find her work at politico.com, and you can find and follow her, and you should do so, on the Blue Skies at Alice Miranda. Alice, always a delight speaking with you. We may be calling on you sooner rather than later, given all that lies ahead. But thanks for joining us today on the broadcast.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Well, clearly I expect another mess there.
Yes.
And speaking of messes, while I was speaking with Alice, I told you at the top of the show, there's a lot of breaking news going on today and things are quickly moving. Yeah, well, we got some more of that news coming in. Let me review it here. Take a quick break. Come back with that. And Desi Doyen and the Green News Report, as promised, straight ahead on your broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. That music, of course, means Green News Report momentarily. Don't worry, Desi Doyen. I'm going to land this plane on time today.
Yes.
But we do have breaking news from the corrupted right-wing Republican activist Supreme Court majority. The Supreme Court is allowing Texas to use a new congressional district map that was drawn to favor Republicans in an unsigned ruling. Not really a surprise. The lower courts had found, after looking at the actual evidence, that in fact what Texas was doing in their mid-decade redistricting was an unlawful racial gerrymander, not just a partisan gerrymander, which was recently allowed by this same Republican Supreme Court back in 2019, who said partisan gerrymandering is just fine. You can partisan to keep your party in power. You just can't do it based on racial issues. Well, the lower courts, including a three-judge panel of the federal appeals court, with an opinion written by a Trump-appointed judge, found that, in fact, what Texas did was unlawful. And now the Supreme Court, in an unsigned decision, apparently on a 6-3 basis with the three liberal justices dissenting, has said, nope, that's fine. Go ahead. Texas, you can use that map all you want, because it was a partisan redistricting, not a racial redistricting. So they say. Their reasons for coming up with that? Who knows? That does tell me that, well, we'll see what they decide in the days ahead regarding the Voting Rights Act and racial gerrymanders and whether those will soon be allowed as well.
Yep.
Anyway, we'll see if all of this works out next year. In any event, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
Mr. Trump is taking a wrecking ball to the biggest single step any nation has ever taken to cut global warming pollution, cut oil use, and save consumers money at the gas pump.
Trump administration proposes rolling back fuel economy standards, making you pay more for gas. Youth climate activists sue Utah to stop fossil fuel development. Plus,
Venezuela for the American oil companies will be a field day.
Trump's threats against Venezuela are all about the oil.
You don't say. All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We will be discussing the environment. Do we still need one?
Jury's out. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, as winter is coming, it seems strange to talk about heat records, but sure enough, November, really hot, huh?
Yes, it was. November 2025 was the third hottest November ever recorded globally since record-keeping began in the 1850s and clocked in just below 2023 and 2024. That's according to Europe's climate service, Copernicus. Despite a cooling La Niña weather pattern in the Pacific Ocean, 2025 is likely to tie 2023 as the second hottest year on record.
Which is remarkable since it's supposed to be cooler because of that La Niña.
Yep. The Trump administration this week delivered another big gift to big oil and U.S. automakers, proposing a significant rollback of Biden-era fuel economy standards for U.S. cars and trucks. Federal fuel economy CAFE standards have spurred innovation, including into hybrid and electric vehicles, which have cut into oil industry profits. The rules have significantly reduced tailpipe air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions from gasoline-powered cars and trucks. Auto industry experts say reducing fuel efficiency technology is a move that mostly benefits automakers and is unlikely to actually reduce the sticker price of new cars over time, as the Trump Transportation Department claims. Lower fuel efficiency standards also mean consumers will pay much more overall for gasoline over the life of the car.
Yay! Merry Christmas, oil companies.
Experts also say Trump is preventing the United States from competing with China's global electric vehicle dominance.
Merry Christmas, China.
In other news, the Trump administration claims that its escalating attacks on boats in the Caribbean off the coast of Venezuela are in response to drug trafficking, but critics and even some Republicans
and even reality
say it is an attempt by the U.S. government to force regime change in order to exploit Venezuela's resources. Venezuela sits atop the largest proven oil reserves in the world.
Ding, ding, ding.
National security journalist Spencer Ackerman explains on MS Now.
It's very clear to anyone even remotely paying attention that this isn't about drugs at all. They're trying to start a war with Venezuela. They will settle for a coup overthrowing Maduro, and then having American oil companies go in and exploit the oil wealth there.
Well, that sounds familiar.
In Canada, Liberal Prime Minister Mark Carney signed a sweeping agreement this week, laying the groundwork for a new oil pipeline to expand Alberta's tar sands production and exempting the province's energy industry from several environmental laws. Reuters reports that Alberta's top environmental regulator succumbed to pressure from the provincial government and the oil industry to stop enforcing limits on the flaring of natural gas after companies blew through the limit 2 years in a row.
They wouldn't follow the law, so let's just change the law.
European Union nations have reached a deal to ban all imports of Russian natural gas by 2027.
Good.
In the state of Utah, 10 young climate activists filed a lawsuit against the state this week to stop new permitting for coal, oil, and gas development. They argue that continued fossil fuel development is contributing to climate impacts like extreme heat, the worst air quality of any state in the nation, including from intensifying wildfires, and is harming their health and future, violating their state constitutional rights to life, health, and safety.
Those kids are all right.
Finally, sowing seeds of hope in Southern California, a teenager whose home in the Pacific Palisades was destroyed by a record wildfire last January is turning his grief into action. Ramsey Goodyear launched the Seed Bomb Project, enlisting his classmates in crafting what are basically small mud pies containing native wildflower seeds that can be dropped anywhere.
That kid is all right, too. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. See, I bet everyone thought we were going to play The Kids Are All Right there. But that's just what they would expect us to do, isn't it? Expect
yep.
the unexpected here on the broadcast. And where else can you get this much news that you can use in 1 hour? Good luck finding that anywhere else. All right. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks again to my guest today, Alice Miranda Olstein of Politico. And to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always greatly appreciated and an honor to have you here. If you missed any portion of today's show, need to listen again or share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can do it over at bradblog.com where it is free. Thanks to those of you who hit a donate button when you stop by or who go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the social medias, you will find me at The Brad Blog. Desi is Green News Report
yep.
over there on Blue Sky. We'll see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman, landing the plane on time. Good luck, world.